Hey everyone, welcome to this episode of the Sport Kite Podcast. I am your host, Nick O'Neill, and I want to thank you for tuning in and listening. As always, if you like what you hear here on the podcast, consider going to buymeacoffee.com/sportkite and chipping in a few bucks. Every little bit really does help keep this podcast hosted and helps us keep everything kind of running smoothly. So this is an all-volunteer podcast, and the funding that we do take through the buymeacoffee.com website, that does help offset the cost of things like hosting, publishing, all that other good stuff. So thank you. It's in no small part thanks to all of you that have already gone ahead and donated. That has meant that we are now the longest running kite podcast that's out there, excluding kiteboarding, of course. They're special type of folks. But yeah, we are the longest running kite podcast. Really happy to have that going. And so yeah, let's go ahead and get into this episode. It's going to be the first part of a longer conversation and interview that I did with Curtis Jones, who some of you have maybe heard of Curtis Jones. He has been in the sport kite community for quite some time, kind of all around the field, be it on the field as a competitor, a judge, or here recently he's been doing a lot of work with the setting up, the sound system, the judging, the infrastructure side. Especially those of you on the East Coast of the United States, you're probably aware of Curtis Jones and his Wind Wolves team. So a lot of this is going to sound familiar. For those of you that aren't, this is probably a good chance to just kind of crack something open and start learning about one of the people that has been there for the greater part of our sport kite history. So yeah, during our conversation, we not only get kind of an introduction to Curtis, but we also talk about some of the generational disparity and disconnect that is happening for those of us from the old school style of sport kite flying to more of the new style of kite flying. We also talk about judging and advancement of tricks, changes in the sport kite competition over the year, and what it may take to create an actual sport kite flyer. And lastly, in this portion of the conversation, we talk a little bit about how some outside influences can affect what we do, specifically referring to an incident that happened at Cocoa Beach that is now affecting how future kite flying may happen in that area. So yeah, give it a listen. Let me know what you think. I would love to hear any of your input or thoughts or comments, questions, concerns, stuff like that. You can always reach me at info@sportkite.com. Would love to hear from you. And yeah, let's go ahead and hop into this episode, and do stay tuned because we will be releasing more of this conversation with Curtis Jones at a later date. All right, here we go. Welcome everyone to the Sport Kite Podcast. I am super excited to be doing an interview today with someone who has quite an extensive history on the sport kite field, not only as a flyer, but in the runnings of and kind of just a very comprehensive background, which we'll get into, but I will let him introduce himself. So Curtis, you care to introduce yourself?
Well, hello there, kite folks. I'm regional director of the AKA Region 2. I am the head of Wind Wolves Traveling Kite Show, if you haven't heard of that, on the East Coast. What else? I've been around since I started flying kites way back in, well, we can talk about that, but extensively in competition sport kites back in the 90s, early 90s.
And just real quick, the Wind Wolves show that you do?
Wind Wolves, yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, from my experience with you, is that I know a lot of times that involves you doing the announcing, the kind of the music and everything else. As someone who is familiar with sport kites, you have that unique ability to be able to actually talk about it to the general public, right? Does the Wind Wolves kite show or traveling kite show, does it involve anything other than just announcing and flying kites?
Well, overall, I mean, from my experience, I modeled a lot of what we do from Newport Kite Festival that got developed after the competition died off up there, that we started adding things. I mean, it's not, you know, groundbreaking, you know, candy drops. We do these bubble storms versus bubbling. We get like 10, 20 people to do bubbles at the same time. We started just trying to bring more people involved on the field. The typical rope battles, except we turned it into a sponsorship type of deal. So sponsors will pay to be in the rope battle. And we put their logos or their brands on the Tyvek ropes. And then as an announcer, I get to announce who's winning. So if it's Smart Water against Red Bull, and their name and brand gets said over the mic over and over and over again. So, and I always did that before we started doing that. I always talked about the kites. I never talked about the guys on the ground because nobody could tell what's going on the ground. So that's where that came from. And the idea, the model of that actually came from when I lived in Hawaii. They used to have bed racing, and they were all sponsored, and they got very serious in Waikiki with it, where they were bringing on in track guys from college, and they would have different themes, and that was one way to promote businesses. And they had a big parade, and they would race beds down the middle of Waikiki. So it's kind of similar kind of thing going on there, is where I got that idea. So
I really love it. It's you're more focused on the audience involvement and the audience enjoyment, and also being that bridge, right, between complicated understanding of sport kites and the layman trying to enjoy what they're seeing, and then adding in all the other audience involvement stuff, like you said, the bubbles, the rock battles, the everything else. It's definitely something I appreciate more and more as I see festivals kind of kicking sport kites out. So,
well, you know, without a doubt, I mean, we might as well just go ahead and dive deep into it. You know, as the way the sport kites have been, in my opinion, this is just my opinion and my experience and perspective. You know, I believe, and I'm not blaming anyone. I mean, as a family of kite flyers, I think we all could take some responsibility if we participated. But I believe we just got too complicated back in the day and got what I call an implosion, where we didn't care about the audience. People that know me and listening, they're going to know, they're going to hear this mantra from me. It's all about the show. And the more we get people to hold kite lines, understand what they're seeing. Even now, like even on our show kites model that I do every Tuesday and Wednesday at Seaside Heights and Seaside Park, I will try and put a kite up with a 100-foot tail, because the non-competitors and non-sport kite people, this is like training wheels. Now they see where the kite has been and where it's going all at the same time, and it registers in their head and it makes sense. If you're without a tail and you're doing tricks, they don't know what's going on. And everybody knows. So if they're listening to this, they know all the stories about you need a tail on the kite and blah, blah, blah. But again, it is all about the show in every aspect and every kite form. You know, I think if you're just trying to do one thing, it can get boring. I love my big kites. I just got a Batman and a Spider-Man, and it just kills. And I got a 50-foot sperm whale white, which nobody else did that I have seen online. I'm like, Moby Dick, that's obvious. Why don't you do that? I see red ones. I see all these other ones. I'm like, Moby Dick. You know, funny part about that, I'm on the boardwalk and I hear kids going, it's a beluga. It's a beluga. It's not a beluga. What are you talking about? It's Moby Dick. And then I realize how old I am. And I just fell through, alternate time warp of some kind.
Yeah, kites are supposed to make us feel young. And then there are times where you're like, oh, this major cultural reference is so lost.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think I just kind of took it for granted that something that, you know, could have been in schools or something to read back. But read? Oh, my God, no. So, you know, anyway, one of the things, the other pieces that come to me for getting people involved is that's how I got involved. So many, many lifetimes ago in Hawaii, I was a DJ. I had a mobile sound system and I was a club DJ. And this major hotel, the CEO, or somebody connected to it anyway, decided they were going to have a kite festival. And they brought me in for the sound. And that's where I met top of the line guys. My first time I saw a spin sock the size of a school bus. The first time I think I saw Scott, I can't remember his last name, still out there in Hawaii. Very young back then in flying quad line. He actually, if I remember correctly, he was flying revs with two revs at the same time with one handle kind of on his hips, or where those lines would go to a handle on his hips. And he was going to music with that. And I fell in love with it. But when I truly found out what it was like was, I think they had trilobies or something with some dual line small ones where they put a tail with Velcro on it. And you would stand next to somebody and you would try to take the other person's tail off. And I won. And after never touching one of these things, and I think that's where it started for me as far as sport kites are concerned. I won that kite and I went around the island and started flying all over the place. And not until I moved from Hawaii did I start seeing the competition. But I did have a chance with my brother-in-law to fly the Hawaiian chevrons and the big rev ones. But back in that day, there was a lot of metal, a lot of hose connections, fiberglass. And, you know, I wasn't flying until I was knee deep in the sand, just thinking that I've harnessed the power of wind gods. And the noise of that fabric ripping through the air. So, which later on became, you know, when you needed a light hand, it took me a longer learning curve to adjust.
To adjust, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, some things you said just in that bit kind of reminded me of a conversation I just had in one of the Facebook groups asking about the styles of sport kite flying and, you know, what you enjoy watching.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know, I'm going to speak from the perspective of an audience, the slightly uneducated audience. I was like, all those tricks are awesome. Slackline tricks are awesome, but they look like flippy floppy. You have no idea what you're doing. Put a tail on it.
Yeah.
And one of the other people got just really upset with me and kind of started a rough dialogue. And I'm just like, I'm sitting here on the beach. I was having a little break. I'm sitting in there on the beach at Lincoln City watching a guy fly three, I think they were pro dancers of all things, with tails on it. And he's wowing the crowd. And it's just, the crowd is going nuts. He's just doing,
James,
you know.
James.
Yeah.
Yes, James came down to Cocoa Beach and he is accelerating. I think he was an ex-cop. And,
mm-hmm.
and
yeah.
he is
yeah.
moving fast. He's picking up real fast.
And not to take away from his flying, right? I don't want to say that he's not skilled, but he is literally just doing circles in the sky, figure eights, and he did, you know, a few refuels, and the crowd went nuts.
Yes.
And then when some dual line flyers get out there, and proficient dual line flyers, right? There was one person who did a lot more tricks, and it just, they were technically proficient. It was amazing. And the crowd was like, oh, good job. Right.
Yeah.
And then Paul gets out there and he flies a handful of tricks in his routine, but just big showpiece, you know, stuff, and then little tricks here and there punctuated, and the crowd got it.
That's exactly right.
So when I said, you know, most tricks, they look 90% unintentional to the majority of people, it's boring.
Well, Nick, the epitome, the mastery of that art form is taking from the days of the beginning when landing was a trick, to putting all of these tricks more than I could ever do. Jesse Kasman just flew up at Newport, and you know he's got an extensive history. That's where his blood and DNA is up in there, and he was the best one up there. But he's also one of the youngest. Most of us are kind of fading away. But going back to what you're talking about, the tricks are fantastic. I think in my own, as far as the show is concerned. And I'm going to tell you everybody now that when I speak from the perspective of show, so don't think I'm putting anything down that what you do as a weekend warrior or anything. Not at all. But I think 120 lines, 100s, if you can do it, bigger palette to work on, finding music that has things in it. I mean, this is all classic. It's explained by some of the greats of our time, the people founding, you know, flying to music. Do all the tricks you want, but put it in a context that's understandable. That is all. And like you said, they'll get it, you know, once you do that. I remember when, for people that don't know, Ron Graziano, a good friend of mine, through competition days, he came in and he watched. I called him the Tiger Woods of kite flying, sport kite flying, because he was the first one in the field and the last one off. We just had to drag him off to go get something to eat. He also watched films that he got from other flyers, people from Europe and whatnot. So he understood tricking before a lot of us did that had been in the circuit on the East Coast for a while. And at first, a couple of times as a novice flyer, he came in and he was just doing a lot of great 90-degree turns to the music. And I looked at him and I remember talking to him and a couple of us talking. It's like, you're great, but you got all these other tricks you see you do. How come that isn't in the routine? And he says, because the old judges hate the tricks. And I'm like, nah, if you put it in the right place at the right time, they'll swallow it. And eventually, of course, he was then 3 years competing with all those guys, Tinkums and Lamb Hawk, of course. And
Tinkums being Patty and Sean?
Yeah, Patty and Sean, yep. Tinkum. And, you know, it was kind of the same top five. Dennis Smith and a few other people. And I think by the time we got to Gettysburg and the AKA convention, I think competition was already dead, but we were just in we were just stubborn or just muscle memory and, you know, just like coming out and doing stuff. But as far as new people coming in, after we started changing the rules, and I feel like a rant coming on. When the rules started going from when we switched from 1 to 10 to 1 to 100, and then we added decimal points on it, it just, and then divided up each of those things, it just got crazy. And then we also didn't tell people that were watching back in the days of Wildwood that did come and watch, they didn't get to find out the end of the story because we didn't announce who won until dinner time. So everybody went home. They don't even know what they saw. So they didn't get educated on what's a winning routine and what's a losing routine, or what they like or they didn't like. And the other part was, because we put these rules in of what is going to be considered good kite flying, a lot of the music kind of went over to movies sound, basically all the music, you know, and it was over and over again. It wasn't exciting enough for the crowd, for the show. It wasn't popular. Brian Vanderslice, we used to go on and like, are we flying for the crowd or are we flying for the judges? And he said, F that, fly for the crowd. And he never cared. He didn't care whether he came in first. He flew a bag in quad. He was really dedicated. So all of these things are part of my DNA of going through the experience of kite flying and to where I'm at now.
Yeah, the simplification of judging has been something like high on my mental priority list, right? We did a roundtable chat with a group of people at a sport kite camp, what was it, a year ago, 2 years ago, where we kind of came up with this idea for a new type of competition, right? And it was coming directly from the approach of what is the easiest thing for an audience to understand? And scoring needs to happen right away. And you need to have like first, second, third, the moment that everybody is done, there should be maybe 5 minutes before you post the scores and everybody should see the scores.
Yes. Right?
Totally. So that exactly what you're saying, people who may have been there watching, they know, or even if they're only watching half of the competition, they see the ranking, right? So that person just flew, he got, you know, we'll use a score system instead of time. The conversation of the roundtable we did was about time trial. But okay, so that person got an 8. Well, the person before got a 6. So okay, that person, so they get that instant calibration of what they're watching. Okay, so now I may be invested. What's this next person gonna do? And they do their thing, and then a minute later the score is posted. They got a 7. Oh, okay, so it's somewhere in between the past two, right? Yeah. So you start getting calibrated, you start seeing, and it helps the audience understand without understanding the intricacies of choreography, the intricacies of, you know, what a precision trick did it perfectly rotate at, you know, this level and stay flat right here, or did it sink a little so I docked them, you know, 5 points. They don't get that. Why would they? It's so incredibly complex. And then you add on top of that the very thick infrastructure required to do a sport kite competition. I think I sat down one time and it's what? Like you need 7 officials to run a sport kite comp?
Yeah. Well, and also you got to
take. It's ridiculous.
You got to take a college course just about, at least a semester. And that was one of the other failings. But you brought up a good point about the 1 to 10. If you know, I did that video, before I forget, Wildwood Then and Now, and it goes back to the 80s when that's online. If you look that up on YouTube, I believe it's on YouTube, and it shows the difference from the 80s into the early 90s and how much it changed, but it shows the roots. And one of the things it shows that I edited a bunch of stuff together that Roger Tuning was trying to make this like a wide world of sports kind of thing. So he brought in some heavy duty hitters. I mean, it looked like Channel 2 or whatever the channel was for sports, and you know, an official announcer, and it sounded really good. And he had several years, and I just took the best out of all of them, you know, the first year of the Rev, Lee Cedric doing his famous Lady in Red routine with a dog stake, showing some different teams and stuff, and refueling. And but the most important thing was that there was a table out on the beach where the judges sat, and they had 1 to 10 cards. And just like ice skating, they did 1 to 10. And it was just so simple. Now, fast forward that all the way to Treasure Island, Florida, where Windworks Store, a guy named Joe down there, started sponsoring this club of kids. And thank you to Prism, helped sponsor and there's about 10 to 12 kids. Now I'm talking double digit kids, not just the kids running around in circles with sled kites. Put dual lines in their hands. Lisa Willoughby, Scotty, Weeder, and some of us went down and did some seminars on Veterans Day. And then they had the official event where they would compete. But they weren't really competing. It's more like a fun club. Kind of, I say Boy Scouts. They don't like to hear that. But they support each other. And these kids are learning. And then some of them are coming back after they get out of school, get out of high school, and they're coming back. It's a great model to teach. And one of the things that we did during that time was when we did the official event and competition, we had the sheets with the score sheets with, you know, 1 to 100 plus decimal to the thousandth. And what we did was we scored first 1 to 10 on the back of the paper on our clipboards and told the announcer what that score was immediately after, before the next person came out onto the field to fly. Now, here's the interesting thing. The scores matched up. What you like from 1 to 10 that you did 1 to 100 to the thousandth decimal and all the time it took to go back and put it in your computer to have it spit out, we already had it. And the crowd got it. And what was even better was if the crowd thought the Georgians were wrong, they got into it, which says a lot because they're paying attention. If they thought that they should have got scored higher, doesn't matter whether they know sport kite flying that much to make that call. The most important thing is that they're paying attention. They're watching. You got eyeballs, and eyeballs are the key. As many as you can get.
Yeah, fully agree. And I love what it's the Volans, right? Doing the flying mantas at Treasure Island.
Yes.
Yeah. We did an interview with Brett and Bonnie, the couple that's essentially leading that. And I think it was like episode 42 or something of this podcast where we sat down and we had that conversation with them. Because they have a great model for bringing youth into sport kite competition and flying. And personally, for me, what I really loved about that, not only that they're getting these kids involved and actually making them flyers. So not just, here's a kite, go have fun. We're going to go fly for the weekend. But was that they also taught things like field etiquette.
Yes.
And, you know, all the other little eccentricities that I think get lost for most of us because we're self-taught.
Yeah.
And we don't learn about it till we go to a festival or event. And 9 times out of 10, it's where we get our hands slapped for, don't do it that way, you know? So there's no, like, base level training for some of the basics to help people kind of move forward. So in a way, when the rest of us are solo learning, those, and we say we go to a festival or event and we learn that, like, oh shoot, I shouldn't be leaving my lines out, right? Like,
right.
When I'm back home, I'm always leaving my lines out. Why would I care, right? But now I'm at this thing, it kind of becomes a knockback in your learning progress. And so it can be disheartening because then you show up and people are like, dude, don't do that. And you're like, what the hell? I just want to fly.
Yeah.
So.
Well, there's definitely the different flying that, you have your, like you said, you're out in a public field, whatever flying, and then you have competition flying, and then you have show flying, which kind of brings me to a thing that people are making fun of me because I keep pushing to don't say demo, say performance, because golly, demos are selling.
Oh my God. Yes. Yes.
And I keep saying, and people, some people are getting it. Some people and when I hear people say demo, it makes me think, not that they are, but that's why we're not advancing in the show part, because we still have one foot in the competition mode. And what that does is hand tie us into being creative. And we still do things in, you know, even me, I'm guilty of it too. It's like, you know, why can't you fly dual line and quad, you know, together in teams? And that's been done a few times, but still, I don't feel like we really, you know, when you look back, I'm going to go back to Wildwood then and now, everybody was doing all kinds of dance. They were flying with frisbees. They were, you know, doing flips, just flying with their hips and just having that kind of freedom. Even indoor kind of succumbed to competition mode, because when that first started in Wildwood in competition, you could wear costumes, you could bring in props, nothing was out of bounds except the audience. And even that, you know, we're kind of still seeing that now where people are just, they're just flying and only a few people are still subscribing to maybe, you know, putting on a theme or coming up with some stuff, which is why, you know, I really loved Cocoa Beach, which we can talk about, which we did the indoor with black lights and introduced a screen and had it a solid timeline of music that was nonstop. And in between the setups, we put some visuals on the big screen and talked about Earth. And they were basically quotes from different astronauts over time, what they thought about when they look back at Earth. So the whole theme of the indoor was about Earth, since we were down at Cocoa Beach, and bringing in lights and stuff, and using what little neon lights, neon kites, or I'm not sure if you're supposed to use neon, but anyway, kites light up to black lights. And unfortunately, the news on that, we're taking a turn here. What happened in Cocoa Beach, that was extremely successful, although the promotion is tough for indoor because people don't know how to explain it, especially if they haven't seen it. So our contact down there, an organizer, was selling tickets for $60, trying to make it a funding thing for the whole weekend event, which isn't a bad idea. But you, I know you know, as well as many other people out there, sometimes it takes a while for a kite festival or a show to get up to steam, and it will. And I tell a lot of organizers, look, just because we only had this many people this time, plan on it doubling next time. If you had a good weekend, a good day or whatever, a good wind and everything's up, it's gonna double. It's not gonna just add on, it will double. Back to Cocoa Beach, you had the unfortunate thing, this is gonna take us into another chapter of a rant, is and you and I have had this discussion.
I love these things, by the way.
you and I have had a discussion about this when you were president of the AKA, where we had went down to Cocoa Beach. Was our first event there. What was significant about it was being able to not only get hotels and food vouchers for kite flyers, but actually was able to pay majority of them. You know, a lot of people said it couldn't be done. That's another rant I'm going to leave to the side for now. But what happened on Friday night, we were supposed to do a night fly on Friday and then fly all day and then do the indoor on Saturday and then fly on Sunday, and that would be it. On Friday, some people that were not part of the people that Lisa and I brought in for the event, apparently, which I didn't find out until Sunday, but on Friday, before the wind died at 6 o'clock, they were flying about 1,000 foot of manja. And they let the manja go. And the manja apparently was, they might have been using ground up aluminum or something to that effect. It went across the power lines and knocked out the town's electricity.
I heard about that.
Oh, I didn't hear about it until Sunday. I didn't know anything about it. I didn't know the lights went out. I didn't know. And I had to go CSI all of it to find out, because I knew all the guys. I thought that if any of our guys would have done it, somebody would have told me themselves if they did it, or somebody that saw it happen would have told me. So apparently these people had nothing to do with this, but the people that approve these things, they don't know that. All they know is that a kite show came to town and their lights went out. And even if they weren't responsible for it, this is what you're attracting. So by the grace of the organizer down there, she's fought honorably to keep us there. So this 2024, unfortunately, we're not going to be able to revisit the indoor, and we're not going to be able to do the night fly, which I've been dying to do a night fly from my perspective for a while now. But the good news is we still have it, because I've heard other places that have had situations similar to this and never had kite flying ever again. So if we do good this 2024, and we cut out half of everything that we did last time, we kind of got to rebuild and reset. And as long as nothing stupid happens, hopefully 2025 we get back on track with that. But yeah, Manja, I'm gonna say one thing on that. Ever since that and DC, I don't know if you knew about this, but the Detroit Chammers came down. They're celebrating their 50th year as a team. The guys from Detroit with the team with the stacked kites, Gary and those guys, they got cut out of the sky by Manja in the middle of their routine. Then we also had some other people flying some fighter kites over the field and buzzing my and Jim Koska's head and thinking it was funny. So I have decided that when I do the events, any public events, and I know we're going to get an influx of public people, I make an announcement. I make it very real. I make it no Manja, no cutting of any kind. And I would suggest to any other kite MCs out there to do the same before, you know, you could lose your event. And if somebody gets cut, your event is responsible. That's your insurance. Even though you may not know them, and also be aware that sometimes they don't use a whole line of Manja. They may only use 10 feet of it from the kite down. So little tips for the longevity of your events out there.
Fully agree. I've been doing some consulting work kind of on the side with the North American fighter kite groups, right? Trying to, because they believe in line touch, not line cutting.
Right.
And they just can't get traction with doing their activity places. And I was like, because you're not visible. I'm like, look, as an event organizer, mm-hmm. who's uneducated, I would go to Google, or I would, you know, do what have you, look up in the news, and everything about fighter kites is how Manja has sliced, you know, some kid's throat as they were going, or, you know, the danger of Manja has wrapped up the birds and killed all the, I'm like, so yeah. All they hear and see is a negative picture. You guys need to be at the forefront. You need to be out there and showing what you're doing, why it's different, and helping educate the public around here or in your areas that, hey guys, let's not use cutting kites. We respect your culture, but here we don't do that because of the dangers of it. And so, but it's a long slog, you know, cause yeah. I've had Manja come in. I think it was Whiskiff 1 year. And all the big show kites are on one side, right? And then the demonstration fields for the mega flies, the mass ascensions, and the sport kite stuff is on the other. And we camp, you know, like right between the two fields. And I'm looking and I see someone is flying from the road, which goes in between the two fields, and they're flying a little fighter kite on Manja, and they went and they wrapped around some of the big kite lines.
Yep. Yep.
And thankfully it only snapped like two of the bridles, and the kite just, you know, tipped and fell down. But like, you know, that's a $10,000 showpiece that's up there, because it was, it was one of those full stacks with a whole bunch of line laundry.
Yeah.
And it's just like,
and that stack could have came down and hurt somebody, or one of your big shell kites. And yes, in a couple of different places up here, it's a little popular up in this tri-state area. They have some dedicated areas from it. And I did have a person come and try and talk to me about it that is deep within the culture, and but was afraid to say anything. He literally said, and I'm not making this up, the quote is, "I can't let anybody know I'm trying to stop them from doing it, because they will kill me. They will literally kill me." That's how embedded this is. And unfortunately, I don't understand. Okay, it's embedded, but how do you get your yayas out of taking out a show kite, or somebody that's not fighting you, or a Barbie kite of all things? And look, I guess we beat that to death. It's bad. Manja's bad, right?
Yeah, Manja's bad. Don't fly it. Which actually, okay, so to kind of arc it back to sport kites, right?
Yeah.
So I know a handful of people that have flown on Kevlar lines.
Nah. Yes, yes.
And intentionally taken really? Out other sport kites. And I'm like,
why?
Why? I'm like, why?
All right. I hope you kind of enjoyed this first little introduction, this first half of the talk I did with Curtis. And again, we're going to get a lot more detailed in future conversations that I'm going to be sharing here on the podcast. So do stay tuned. I just kind of wanted to get out this introductory little bit, just a conversation. You may have noticed this is the same type of conversation that I've been having with a lot of the prominent sport kite flyers out there. So I guess that says something. I think for me, that says that a lot of us kind of have the same thought, and we're all just kind of trying to figure out how to make certain things happen. We have the same memories, we have the same actions, and we just want to make the future better, brighter, and all of that. So, a lot of us are just kind of looking for the right answer or an answer to try and make this community greater. So do you have a suggestion? I'd love to hear it. Again, you can always reach me at info@sportkite.org, or you can go to our Facebook page or even our Instagram. Just look for Sport Kite Flyer. Give us a shout. Let us know. Drop, you know, all your good stuff. And we'd love to share your thoughts here on the podcast. So if you're comfortable with it, I'm more than happy doing an interview with you, talking to you, sharing your path, your suggestions, your thoughts here. And yeah, just one last little note. So you're aware, on my sister site, fortunafound.com, I am going to be publishing a lot of archive videos, including Sport Kite archive videos, which will be linked to the sportkite.org website. But you should be able to see a lot of kite history past. So while I'm trying to add what we have going on right now, I'm also trying to do a lot of backdating and catching up the information from sport kite history past, so that we can see not only where we want to go, but where we've been. So give it a like and a follow. Let me know if there's a certain video you are looking for, or if you have VHS cassettes, I'm more than happy to convert them to a digital file. You just have to get them over to me. And you can always shoot me an email or contact me, and we can work out exactly how that would happen. All right, with that, I'm going to go ahead and sign off, and I'll catch you guys on the next one.